On the 10th of December 1983, Nkutula Simelane entered the underground parking of Carlton Center in Johannesburg. A 23-year-old student of the University of Swaziland, she was a member of the armed wing of the ANC known as Umkhonto we Sizwe, the Spear of the Nation. Simelane acted as a courier between Swaziland and South Africa and came to Carlton Center to meet another ANC operative, or so she thought. In fact, she was betrayed and instead of her contact was confronted by men from the security branch of the South African police. She was abducted and first taken to the workers' quarters of the Norwood police barracks, where she was held for a week before being taken to an isolated farm in the north of the country, where for several weeks she was viciously tortured and interrogated by the security branch, who wanted her to turn into an informant, somebody who could be deployed to change sides and start informing on her comrades. She refused. After weeks of torture, she was last seen in a booth of a car with four security branch officers. After that, she was never seen again. The family immediately started the quest to find out what happened to her, but never expected much from the apartheid authorities. When the new democratic government came into power in 1994, they had high hopes that the new authorities would take action on their behalf. This never happened. The family changed tactics and got Nkutula's story into a local newspaper, and as a result of that, one of the black police officers involved in her abduction and torture came forward. As a result of his testimony, a police docket was opened in 1996. Several suspects approached the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was then in operation, to seek amnesty for participating in her abduction and torture. Most of them were granted amnesty for abduction and kidnapping, but nobody applied to be amnestied for her enforced disappearance and murder. Despite the fact that nobody was held accountable for Simelane's murder, the case was never taken up by the prosecutors as required by the law. Nkutula Simelane's case was not the only one where the National Prosecuting Authority failed to pursue perpetrators despite them not applying for amnesty under the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's mandate. There are in fact more than 300 such cases. Behind the veneer of reconciliation, based on internationally celebrated groundbreaking truth-seeking effort, in fact lurked impunity shaped by political interference into efforts of prosecutors who took their job seriously and tried to pursue these apartheid-era cases. However, Nkutula Simelane's family did not give up. After years of hearing lies about the investigation being underway, her sister Thembi Nkadimeng, with the help of a human rights lawyer she met at a conference in Johannesburg, petitioned the High Court in Pretoria to order the National Prosecuting Authority to act one way or the other. And finally, on the 8th of February, 33 years since the day when Nkutula was kidnapped, the family prevailed. Four security branch officers, Msebenzi Timothy Vastrepradebe, Anton Pretorius, Frederick Barnand Mong, and Willem Helm Johannes Ketze, will be prosecuted for Simelane's murder. On 26th February, they will stand before a judge to face their charges. Beside the judge, in the courtroom, they will have to face Nkutula's mother, sister, and two brothers. At their side, as part of their legal team, will be that human rights lawyer from Johannesburg. His name is Howard Varney, and today he's our guest. Howard, let me congratulate you and start this conversation by asking you how does it feel to achieve a victory of this kind after such a long time?
It has been a very long journey for the family, for Nokutela Simelane's mother, sister, and brothers. It's also been a long road for the legal team. And although it is a very significant and very historic decision that the National Prosecuting Authority has made to prosecute four of the suspects in this case, this is only one milestone. There's still a long journey ahead. We still have to make sure that the prosecution is properly supported, that it is a coherent prosecution, and that justice is done in due course. So we have achieved one milestone, but there's several more to go.
Howard, can you please briefly walk us through the history of this case from your perspective, from your involvement about its progress and the obstacles that it has faced over the years?
My contact with the family first happened in 2005 when I attended a conference near Johannesburg. In fact, it was a conference organized by several organizations, including the International Center for Transitional Justice. And it was at that conference that I met Thembi Nkadimeng, the sister of Nokutela Simelane. She spoke at that conference. She was articulate, and she spoke of the long suffering of the family and the endeavors they had made to privately investigate this disappearance in the absence of action being taken by the authorities. I then offered my services to the family as a lawyer, and on behalf of the family, I've started the process of meeting and writing and lobbying the police and the prosecutors to take action. Various promises were made, and a number of meetings were held and correspondence exchanged. But sadly, nothing yielded fruit. And as a result of that inaction, we then decided over the last few years that we were going to take private action by way of a High Court application to compel the prosecutors to make a decision. At that stage, we requested an inquest, which was originally refused on the basis that they were still investigating. And when it appeared that the so-called investigations were never going to end, we then launched an application to the High Court in Pretoria to compel the prosecuting authority to make a decision, any decision, a decision to prosecute, a decision not to prosecute, or a referral to a judicial inquest before a court. And as a result of those proceedings, the National Director of Public Prosecutions eventually decided to take action.
It is very difficult for someone from the outside who sees South Africa as this poster example of transitional justice and national reconciliation based on the great work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To understand why has it taken a petition to the High Court to get the National Prosecuting Authority to investigate this. Can you please tell us about what has happened here? What were these government's secret and not so secret efforts directed in ensuring impunity for those not granted amnesty, and why? Why?
Well, that's a good question, Rafik. And as you point out, South Africa has been a poster child for transitional justice. And the centerpiece of that process has been the celebrated and famous Truth for Amnesty process, which we all know so well. Namely, if you disclose the truth, you get your immunity from both civil actions as well as criminal liability. But if you don't, if you spurn the process, you don't apply for amnesty, or you get refused amnesty, that you then face the consequences. And given that approach, which we all thought was an innovative and groundbreaking approach, South Africans, in particular families of victims of individuals, of perpetrators who didn't get amnesty, were expecting all along something to happen, some consequences to flow, investigations to proceed, and where appropriate and where the evidence was available, then prosecutions, so that they and the public could see justice done. And as you know, less than a handful of cases have been taken forward since the Truth Commission handed over a list of several hundred, around 400 cases for further investigation. We now know the reason why there has been this inaction over the years. We had speculated all along that there might have been some kind of political interference that had been brought to bear on the office of the public prosecutors. And we now know that that in fact was the case, because in preparing the High Court application in the Simelane matter, I approached the former National Director of Public Prosecutions, Vusi Pikoli, as well as the senior prosecutor who was in charge of the unit that handled the RC cases. And they confirmed to me in sworn affidavits that these investigations were closed down, that they were unable to take them forward because of the political obstructionism. And in fact, the former National Director of Public Prosecutions described in his affidavit how he was called into various meetings. Sometimes these meetings would take place at night at the home of cabinet ministers, and he was simply told that these cases could not proceed, because if they did proceed, they would be opening up a can of worms, and that if the prosecutors went against the former police and military officers, it would then open the door to cases against the ruling party and possibly even sitting government officers. And that really explains why there has been this dreadful inaction. An effective suspension of these cases has been in place since 2007, when the chief prosecutor informed government that he intended to respect his oath of office and that he would respect the independence accorded to him under the Constitution, and he would proceed with these cases. He was then suspended from office within a few weeks of his communication to government, and the prosecutor in charge of the cases was then relieved of his duties in relation to those particular dossiers. So that's the sad story, Rafik. It is a story of gross political interference that explains why these cases have never seen the light of day. The big question going forward is that now that this has been revealed in these proceedings, and we have at least one decision to prosecute a most deserving case, what is going to happen to all the others? Will the prosecutors and the investigators do the right thing, or will those families also have to go to court to see justice done?
Well, this is exactly what my next question was going to be. But before that, just for our listeners to say that there is a storm on your end, and we are not adding these sounds of thunder for dramatic effect. It is actually happening as we speak. But going back to the conversation, what implications do you think that the case will have in terms of being perhaps a turning point for the NPA in prosecuting these cases which counted on some sort of backdoor amnesty?
I think it's true to say that this particular case has opened a door. The question remains is how wide that door is going to be opened. But nonetheless, it is, as I mentioned, still extremely significant and historic because it is the first case that has been taken forward in nearly 10 years. And the taking forward of this case begs the question as to what is going to happen to all the other several hundred cases that have been gathering dust in the offices of the National Prosecuting Authority. We have already selected a few cases which we have brought to the attention of the National Director of Public Prosecutions, and we have investigated those cases, and we believe there are grounds for further investigation as well as either a judicial inquest to overturn earlier findings that nobody was to blame for the deaths of individuals in security police detention, or there may even be grounds for prosecution. And we have several other matters that we are investigating as we speak, and in due course we will be approaching the National Prosecuting Authority and presenting these cases to them. We hope that the NPA has been instigated into taking action, and that is not simply going to be this particular case, and that they themselves have taken their own initiative to pursue cases. We have been advised by the NDPP that this is in fact what they're doing. We have not been told which cases are being investigated. But for the moment, we will give the new National Director of Public Prosecutions the benefit of the doubt and assume that he will prosecute this case seriously, and he will pursue other cases with the attention that they deserve.
Do you expect any action or at least a public debate to be catalyzed around this as a form of actually obstructing justice in these cases?
A few of the journalists raised the question as to whether the politicians and senior officials who were involved in stopping these cases, whether they could be held responsible for obstructing the course of justice. And that is something that is potentially on the cards. I should tell you that for the moment, the civil case against the National Prosecuting Authority has been placed in abeyance. And it's in the civil case where these very serious allegations have been made in sworn affidavits, as well as documentation between the then Ministry of Justice and the then National Prosecuting Authority. Those documents have been attached to those affidavits, including a top secret memorandum which has been attached to an in-camera affidavit, so it's currently not publicly available, but it also goes a long way in demonstrating the political interference. So while that case is in abeyance, the matter is for the moment off the table. But certainly interested parties could approach the National Prosecuting Authority with the request that charges of obstructing the course of justice be laid against the responsible officials. That's a possibility. It hasn't happened as yet.
Lastly, Howard, I must ask you about the sort of the broader implications of this decision vis-a-vis the legacy of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Even the chairman of the commission, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, came out with a statement after the decision saying that it was long overdue, and I quote him, he says, "I have long said that there remains unfinished business from the TRC. The tardy and limited payments of reparations to victims of human rights violations eroded the very dignity that the Commission sought to build. The fact that the government did not prosecute those who refused amnesty or failed to apply for amnesty undermined those who did. The proposal of a once-off wealth tax as a vehicle for those who had benefited from the past to contribute to the future was still born, says Archbishop Tutu. Do you think that this could, in a way, be a catalyst for a broader conversation on how the government dealt with the recommendations of the TRC, not only in this particular aspect of prosecuting the perpetrators, but also these other recommendations which have never been acted upon? Do you think there is now some sort of a new momentum?
Sadly, we have to conclude that although the Truth Commission process is largely seen as an inspiring one and a very successful one in helping a relatively peaceful transition to take place in South Africa, the conclusion that can't be refuted is that successive post-apartheid governments have not taken the recommendations of the Truth Commission seriously and sadly have turned their backs on victims. We've seen the political obstruction when it comes to the pursuit of criminal cases. And when it comes to reparations, the tens of thousands of victims who've been excluded from the process, largely because the government is adhering stubbornly to the so-called closed list policy. Unless you are able to make a statement to the Truth Commission and you are able to get onto the Truth Commission's list, you're excluded, regardless of the reason why you weren't able to see a statement taker or get onto that that list. So that's why these organizations, in particular Kulumani, have been protesting and agitating over all these years. And I have to say that it may be that we have to litigate on those cases as well. But I do think that this recent court case has caught the attention of the wider public and has caught also the attention of policymakers in government, including the Ministry of Justice, because only a few weeks ago they agreed to meet with the coalition as well as the legal representatives for purposes of discussing the way forward when it comes to reparations. So yes, we still have a long way to go. 20 years after the winding up of the Truth Commission, this is the 20th anniversary of the winding up of the Truth Commission, incidentally. Victims are still waiting to be accorded fair and appropriate support when it comes to reparations, as well as to have their cases taken seriously by the prosecutors.
Well, we certainly hope that this will be, in fact, a catalyst for this revisiting of the TRC's recommendations 20 years later. And to finish this conversation, Howard, can you just tell us what is the next milestone, the next step in the Simelane case? We understand that on Friday, the first appearance of the accused is scheduled. What is going to happen in the case from now on?
Yes, so on Friday, the 26th of February, will be a significant milestone because for the first time, apartheid-era suspects will appear in court. On that day, they will be asked to plead in relation to the charges of kidnapping and murder. That will be a fairly short hearing, I imagine, because after they have pleaded, the case will then be adjourned, and we'll hopefully get dates for the trial of those four suspects. I'm told that the sister of Nokutula and mother and other family members will be in attendance at court. And so we are looking forward to that day because for the family, it really does mark a turning point. For the very first time in more than 30 years, they are finally seeing action being taken by the authorities. So I think we need to support them on that historic day. And for the rest of us, we will be there continuing to support the family and to monitor proceedings very closely and, of course, to carry on the work in relation to the other cases and to try and get them off the ground as well.
Thank you, Howard, and to all our listeners, until the next ICTJ podcast, all the best.